It's Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a new report finds that the rate of maternal deaths in the United States is the highest in the developed world. We found out why that is and how other countries have made pregnancy-related deaths much less common.
First, the Justice Department announced last night that it has appointed former FBI Director Robert Mueller as special counsel in the investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election.
The move comes a week after the firing of FBI Director James Comey and days after Comey memos were released that seemed to indicate President Trump was asking him to drop an investigation into former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn's ties to Russia.
Callum Borchers joins us now. He covers the intersection of politics and the media for The Fix at The Washington Post. Callum, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's look first at the scope of Mueller's job here as special counsel. What does it entail?
Well, the main thing is that he is going to exist outside of the typical bounds of the Trump-appointed Justice Department, right? The whole idea here is to avoid the inescapable conflict of interest that you would have had with a Trump-picked FBI head leading the investigation the rest of the way forward. Now, of course, whoever Trump picks to replace James Comey will have to go through the Senate confirmation process. But since Republicans control the Senate, there's always that concern that it would just be a rubber stamp, and you're effectively choosing who investigates your own campaign, right? Mm-hmm. So the whole idea is to bring in Mueller. What is, I think, still to be answered, though, is exactly how much freedom he will be given. The special prosecutor sounds great in theory, but as I have looked through the history of special prosecutors, there are instances in which presidents and attorney generals have leaned on special prosecutors or at times yanked them off altogether. Of course, everybody remembers the Saturday Night Massacre, in which Richard Nixon ordered the firing of Archibald Cox. As probably the most famous example, but it's not the only one. I mean, you can go back to the 1800s and President Grant firing a special prosecutor who had been brought in to investigate the Whiskey Ring scandal, which implicated the president's assistant, although not the president directly. So that's kind of the question that we'll have to see going forward. Will Mueller have full freedom and authority to do his own thing, and will he be given all the resources that he needs by the Justice Department to do it?
And how did he arrive on the scene? How was he appointed?
Well, he's a logical pick in the sense that he held the job that James Comey had before James Comey, so he's a natural fit in that sense.
A dozen years.
Exactly. And he is also someone who is highly regarded by both parties. I thought it was notable, again, as somebody who covers the press, I was struck this morning by the strong endorsement that Mueller got from the New York Times editorial board today. They were their message to their readers, who lean left, was that you can rest assured that this investigation will be conducted with integrity. And so I think that that's what Rod Rosenstein was going for. To answer sort of the mechanics of your question, he was picked by Rosenstein, who is the newly installed deputy attorney general. Ordinarily, the attorney general might make the appointment, except that in this case, the attorney general is Jeff Sessions, who was a big-time Trump supporter during the campaign and who recused himself from investigations related to the election because of his own failure during confirmation process to disclose his meetings with the Russian ambassador to the United States. So that's how the responsibility fell down to Rosenstein. And in a perfect little twist of history here, I'm reminded of a scenario that played out in 2003 when you had the Justice Department looking for a special prosecutor to lead the probe into who in the Bush administration had leaked the name of the CIA operative Valerie Plame to the press. You might remember this episode. And again, it was a scenario where John Ashcroft believed that he had a conflict of interest, or at least the appearance of a conflict of interest, and had recused himself. So again, in that scenario, it was the Deputy Attorney General who had to pick the special prosecutor. And in 2003, the Deputy Attorney General was James Comey.
So how long might an investigation like this take? What are we looking at here?
Well, that's a great question. And for all of the leaks coming out of Washington right now, that is one thing that has remained a pretty well-kept secret. James Comey never gave any indication about how far along the FBI's investigation was or how long he thought that it might take. And I have to believe that when Mueller takes over, there will be a little bit of a catching up process, and that he is going to take his time. So I can't even put a timeline on it at this point. Mm.
We're talking right now with Callum Borchers. He covers politics and the media at The Washington Post. We're talking about the appointment of former FBI Director Robert Mueller as special counsel in the investigation into possible Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election. So what do you get as a sense on what's happening on Capitol Hill right now with Mueller's appointment? What are Democrats and Republicans saying about this, and what is the mood like on Capitol Hill?
Well, Democrats are generally happy. You had several dozen Democrats in the Senate calling for a special prosecutor or an independent counsel last week as soon as the president fired James Comey, for the very reason that we mentioned a moment ago, that he was going to get a chance to pick Comey's successor and that an apparent conflict of interest would be unavoidable. Some Republicans have said that they feel as though the selection of an independent counsel is unnecessary, but I have not heard a lot of complaining about Mueller specifically. As I said, he is highly regarded by folks in both parties, and so whether politicians think that he needs to be here or not, I think most of them do trust that he will do a good job.
It's been said that Mueller has prosecution running through his veins, that he is at heart a prosecutor. Won't he be under pressure to bring criminal indictments of some kind to justify his existence?
I would say yes and no. The pressure always exists in a job like this, but part of the beauty of picking somebody like Mueller is that he really doesn't have a whole lot to gain in terms of, you know, ambitions for something else. He's 72 years old. He has been, you know, out of the FBI for 4 years. He is not someone who is here looking for that next gig. And so that should insulate him somewhat from the political pressures that might come with someone else who is thinking, boy, I better not anger this side, or I better make sure I appease this group because I need to be thinking about my future.
Will this in any way put a fear in the White House, in the day-to-day workings of the White House, for everyone, regardless of whether there is guilt or innocence on anyone because of this investigation going on the outside?
I think that the candid answer, if you gave folks in the White House the truth serum, would be yes, on the one hand. However, the way the White House has been framing this publicly and also, you know, privately to journalists is that in some ways the appointment of Robert Mueller is a relief. And by that I mean especially a relief for the communications office, which feels now, at least when Sean Spicer or Sarah Huckabee Sanders is in the briefing room answering questions about what is the latest going on in the investigation, they have an easier time of saying, I'm just going to refer that question to the special prosecutor. I'm going to refer that question to the special prosecutor. Mm. You know, to some degree, they've always been able to say, you know, you'll have to talk to the FBI about that. But because the investigation had always been, you know, conducted under the purview of the Trump administration's Justice Department, there was a closer connection than you have now. So perhaps that is a bit of a relief valve in one sense.
Callum, your news organization, The Washington Post, had obtained audio that allegedly has top GOP lawmakers, including House Speaker Paul Ryan, joking about President Trump's potential ties to Russia. And this was audio well before he was ever nominated. What can you tell us about this recording?
Yeah, it was in a private meeting among Republican lawmakers in the House, and the key line that we and everyone has focused on was when Kevin McCarthy, who is the House majority leader, said that he believes there are two people that Vladimir Putin pays, and one of them he named was Donald Trump. That, of course, was the most significant name. And folks laughed in the room, and then he followed up by saying, swear to God. And it's a little bit difficult to tell how serious he was. Now, the way that his office and Paul Ryan's office have answered questions about it now is to say it was obviously a joke. It was perhaps a failed attempt at humor, but it was just that, an attempt at humor. The problem with just dismissing it as nothing more than a quip is that that's not what they said at the outset. When our reporter reached out initially with the quotes and said, how do you explain this, both the Ryan office and the McCarthy office denied that the remark ever happened. And then we went back and said, well, we have a transcript of the remark. And they said, well, the transcript must be inaccurate. Didn't happen. And then we went back a third time and said, well, we've heard a recording. It definitely happened. And then they said, oh, well, then it was just a joke. So that sort of undercuts their credibility, of course, right? If it was just a joke, well, then why give the false denial in the first place? And, of course, you can also hear on the recording Paul Ryan rather worried that the remark might get out, because he reminds everyone, hey, this is an off-the-record meeting, no leaks, you know, this is how we know that we're a real family, this stays within the family, et cetera. You know, it's possible, of course, that there's a middle ground here, right? And I touched on this in a piece I wrote last night. It could very well be that Kevin McCarthy was joking in the sense that he doesn't literally believe that Donald Trump is cashing checks from Vladimir Putin. But the underlying sentiment of the joke, if it is a joke, is that he believes that Donald Trump is uncomfortably cozy with the Kremlin. And so just the thought that that is a belief held by Republican leadership is a really bad look for the White House.
Thank you so much, Callum. We really appreciate it.
Glad to be with you.
Callum Borchers covers the intersection of politics and the media for The Fix at The Washington Post. He joined us today to talk about the appointment of former FBI Director Robert Mueller as special counsel in the investigation into potential Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election.
For many pregnant women, prenatal care is available every step of the way to make sure their baby is developing normally and will be delivered safely. What may be lost in that, however, is the focus on expectant mothers themselves. And if a mother's health becomes a second thought, the consequences can be tragic.
A new report from ProPublica and NPR finds that in the U.S., women are more likely to die from pregnancy-related issues than anywhere else in the developed world, and by a significant margin. And well over half of those deaths have been deemed preventable.
Nina Martin is a reporter for ProPublica covering gender and sexuality, and she co-authored the piece titled The Last Person You'd Expect to Die in Childbirth. Nina, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So how striking are the numbers on maternal deaths in the United States compared to the rest of the world?
They're pretty striking. In the U.S., the maternal death rate is three times as high as in Canada. It's, you know, six times higher than in Scandinavia. It's more than twice as high as in Great Britain, which is a country that has also a lot of immigration and many of the same kinds of issues that demographic issues that you know are sometimes cited as causes of the higher maternal death rate in the U.S. I think the really important number in a lot of ways isn't just the death rate; it's the rate of women who nearly die. For every woman in the U.S. who dies, and we think there's about 700 to 900 of them a year from maternal related causes, so pregnancy related causes, an estimated 65,000 women nearly die. And often there's very little difference between the two deaths except luck or bad luck. And so really the striking number is you know, those two things together, deaths and near deaths.
And there's been progress made in making sure that babies survive, but what trends are we seeing in mothers surviving?
Well, there have been enormous progress. You know, if you look at compare maternal deaths to, say, the beginning of the 20th century, there's obviously been enormous progress in the U.S., as there has been throughout the developing world, in terms of reducing maternal deaths. What happened about 50 years ago is that the death rate in the U.S. for mothers reached was really brought under control, and everybody said, hey, that's great. That problem is done. And the focus turned to infants, babies and infants, who are, you know, have always been much more likely to die in childbirth than mothers. And so there's been this enormous attention, you know, political, social, funding-wise, and then also within the medical profession and sort of at hospitals and among doctors and nurses, in really really focusing on the baby and the baby's health. And what's happened is that there's been this kind of assumption that has crept into a lot of places, including the medical profession particularly, that it's really the babies who are in danger. And moms are pretty okay. Moms can take care of themselves. Childbirth usually goes pretty well. There's no need to think about them. There's not as much focus on them. There's not as much need to focus on the mom. And so what has ended up happening is that there's been this sort of lack of recognition that, in fact, pregnancies and childbirths have become more complicated for a lot of demographic reasons. Moms are getting older. They're getting heavier. They're coming into pregnancy with more pre-existing conditions. Our healthcare system is really fractured, and people get lost, you know, in the cracks a lot. And so there's been kind of so that doctors and nurses and hospitals very often are not prepared when the emergency happens, and those are really more frequent than people realize.
I think an older term is a woman having died in childbirth, but what we're really talking about here is a maternal period, and what time period is that you're looking at for this data?
So for the CDC, the way they define, basically the maternal period is any time during pregnancy to the end, to a year within the end of pregnancy. So basically a year after a child is born. And one of the really striking things about that is that a lot of recent research shows that the majority, and in some cases quite a strikingly large majority, depending on the state, of maternal deaths and also near deaths, near misses, occur in the postpartum period. People think of childbirth, a death in childbirth, as being Downton Abbey, Sybil dying in Downton Abbey. And in fact, many deaths and near deaths life-threatening complications don't emerge until after a woman has already gone home from the hospital. And they may, depending on the kind of complication, heart-related complications, for example, cardiomyopathies, they may not emerge for weeks or months after a woman has gone home from the hospital.
We're talking with Nina Martin right now. She's a reporter for ProPublica, and she co-authored the piece titled "The Last Person You'd Expect to Die in Childbirth." And Nina, we don't have time to go into all of the twists and turns of the story that you're referencing in that title, but I do want to give our listeners a sense of the kind of stories that you encountered. Lauren Bloomstein was a neonatal intensive care nurse herself, gave birth to a healthy child of her own in the hospital she worked at, but died a day later. What were the points in Lauren's case where the system failed her?
The system failed Lauren pretty much from the beginning, from the moment she went to the hospital. She had had a really healthy pregnancy. She was beloved at the hospital. She chose to give birth at the hospital, you know, in large part because she felt really comfortable with her colleagues, her OBGYN. She thought she would get great care. They wanted to give her great care, but nobody was paying attention to the fact that when she entered the hospital, despite having had a perfect pregnancy, she came in with very elevated rates of blood pressure, a rate so high that it actually meets the clinical definition of preeclampsia. And her high blood pressure continued throughout the course of her delivery. She had a pain at one point that was epigastric pain, and that's actually a signal of liver involvement, which is like severe preeclampsia, but it was misdiagnosed and thought to be basically back labor, and so they gave her more of an epidural. And so she gave birth. The baby was fine. fine. She seemed glowing. You can see the video on our website. It's heartbreaking. She had and then within about an hour and a half after that, really started to complain of major pain. And once again, the pain was misdiagnosed as being gastric pain. It was her blood pressure was kind of misdiagnosed as not being high enough to as far as her doctors and nurses were concerned, to count as preeclampsia, which was incorrect. It was at that point severe preeclampsia. This kind of continued on and on throughout the night. One of the really heartbreaking, until she had a stroke, a massive stroke. And one of the really heartbreaking things about it is that her husband was a doctor, Larry Bloomstein, and he was with her the whole time, and he understood what was going on. He's not an OBGYN, he's an orthopedic trauma surgeon, but he understood that this was not right, that he recognized that it was preeclampsia. He tried to get the doctors and the nurses to pay attention, tried to get, specialists to come in and look at her. And people just sort of kept assuming, I think really they didn't have standards in place to really understand when to go into crisis mode, they didn't understand really clearly what the crisis point was. But also, there's this thing that so many doctors and researchers have told us about, which is that you just really expect everything to be okay. And so there's just this constant expectation that really, it's just a little off, but it's really fine. It's fine. It's Lauren. She's healthy. It's fine. Until suddenly that clearly wasn't true. She had a stroke and she died soon afterwards.
Well, Nina, there's so much more to cover in the report, but we are short on time. Very, very briefly, the British system looks at these kinds of deaths as a system failure. Is there any movement in the U.S. to adopt a similar system?
There are a couple of bills pending in Congress right now that would improve the way that states collect data and analyze data around maternal deaths within the states. Unfortunately, there is no federal system, and there probably will not be a federal system, so we really have to depend on the states. And as you can imagine, some states are more interested in looking at these issues and spending money on them than others. So
we'll have to leave it there. Nina, thank you so much for joining us. That was Nina Martin. She's a reporter from ProPublica covering gender, sexuality, and women's health, and she co-authored a new report on maternal deaths. This is Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, we'll speak to State Assembly Representative Daniel Reamer about new proposed legislation that would protect Wisconsinites with pre-existing conditions from higher insurance rates.
First, when was the last time you were bored? Well, it's great being fulfilled and entertained all the time, both at work and in our personal lives. Most of us succumb to boredom every now and again, but is that necessarily a bad thing?
Our next guest wanted a deeper understanding of boredom, why we get bored, how we deal with it, and what it says about us as humans. And while some might think that boredom is sort of, well, boring, she says that this little examined emotion has a complex and surprisingly colorful story to tell. And that's a lot that we can learn about ourselves in the process.
Mary Mann's new book is Yawn, Adventures in Boredom. Mary, thanks for joining us.
Hi.
Hi. So what inspired you to write this exploration on boredom? What's behind this?
I started thinking about it when I was in grad school. I was in a writing program, and there was so much concern about being boring. And that was such a big thing that when someone had something bad happen to them, people would almost be jealous because they'd be like, oh, you have something interesting to write about. And it became interesting to me that we were all so nervous about being boring because it seemed to give boredom this kind of power that I was interested in. So I started reading about it and thinking about it.
And losing yourself in libraries.
yeah, a lot of that.
And so from a psychological perspective, what did you learn about the role that boredom plays?
Well, like you said in the intro, it is pretty complex. There's bad parts about it. There's if you're having long-term chronic boredom, there are studies that show that can connect with depression. It correlates pretty highly with loneliness, that kind of stuff. And then there's good things that can get out of it. There's several studies that show that if you're bored for, you know, short periods of time, if it's not a chronic thing, that you start thinking more creatively, you start having more associative thoughts, all kinds of stuff like that.
And Mary, you, it was really informative, I think, in your book, because you had a job coming out of college that was extremely boring. You were a host in a restaurant,
yeah.
seating tables, and you were incredibly bored. You couldn't look at your phone. You really kind of exposed yourself in your book here. What did you learn about yourself as you researched boredom?
That's funny you bring up that job. It was during the recession, too, which was especially why it was boring.
The Great Recession.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good question. I included myself in the book partly because I was interviewing so many people, and boredom can be something that people are embarrassed about. So it didn't feel right to ask people to tell me their stories and not include my own. And so that was why I initially did it, but through writing some of my own stuff in there, I did sort of realize some things about how I spend my time and the things that I love and the things that I don't love, and be a little gentler on myself about wasted time.
That first job, that boring job, how has that informed your life getting started that way in the Great Recession with a job that was incredibly boring? How has that impacted you?
Well, it's definitely given me some tolerance for it, which is good, especially in New York City, riding the trains all the time. But also, I think there's something to knowing what it's like to be bored. There's so many people in the world who are stuck sort of in boring situations, whether it's in factories or waiting in really long lines to get care that they need, or being in jail, and it's kind of a humanizing sort of thing to think about, like my situation is very different from theirs, but we've all had similar kinds of feelings. And I guess that's true of any human feeling, but this is the one I spent time with, so.
But Mary, you actually talked with, I believe it was your aunt, expecting her to say that her job in, I believe it's an orange juice processing plant, was really boring, and actually, she wasn't that put off by it.
It's true. Cousin Connie is amazing. She said it wasn't boring. She said it wasn't interesting. She's wonderful. I don't think everybody's bored by the same things at all. There is a book called Rivet Head that's really great, and the author, whose name I'm blanking on right now, worked in an automobile factory, and a big part of that book is like how terribly boring it was and how painful that was for him. But Connie's super chill with it. So I think it's just different jobs hit different people in different ways.
We're talking right now with Mary Mann. Her new book is Yawn, Adventures in Boredom. Mary, let's talk a little bit about boredom at the workplace. And I'm sure many people have complained about being bored at work, but one of the questions you spend time focusing on was, what's really so bad about being bored at work? And did you get clear answers to that question? What did you find?
Well, again, it's different for different people. I think there is an expectation that's sort of new to maybe our century, the 20th century at least, that work should be really fulfilling, that we should feel this kind of passion for our work, you know, that sort of do what you love idea. And that can be sort of dangerous, because then when you do get bored, and everybody gets bored occasionally, or at least most of us do, then when you do get bored, it feels like a big failure. It feels like you've really screwed up, and it's really okay. It should be okay to be bored sometimes, and to maybe even admit it. And that was partly where that question came from, was talking to a friend of mine who has what he thinks is a very boring job, and he said it made him feel so much better just to talk about that.
How can it take a toll on a person being bored in their career, in their work?
Well, it does correlate pretty highly with depression. It can be a real, I mean, it is sort of the definition of a grind, and that wears you down. I talked to a few people with jobs like that who sort of were struggling and trying to figure out how to make it work, and failing at trying to find any sort of satisfaction with their jobs. There's also studies that say that boredom helps us figure out what we're meant to be doing, or that what we're doing in the moment doesn't have any purpose. And that seems to connect with that part of, like, if your job doesn't feel good, if it feels pretty boring, maybe it's not the right job.
Well, and what does it mean? I mean, it feels like being bored at work is kind of shorthand that could actually be an umbrella for a lot of things. Is it not having enough to do? Like, literally, there's not enough to do and I'm just sitting here. Or is it, this is not challenging me intellectually? Or is it that I don't feel any meaning? I don't feel like I'm contributing anything by doing this job, even if I'm busy all the time. Like, did you get a sense of what it is that people mean when they say that they're bored at work?
I mean, you've kind of hit it. It's a lot of those things. The word boredom is sort of an umbrella term that we use to describe a big range of emotions. Sometimes when people say they're bored, they're really angry and irritable. Sometimes they just feel like paralyzed, like, oh, I can't even move. You know, there's different feelings that are encompassed in boredom. For most people that I spoke to, the kind of boredom that they felt at work was what I like to call like busy boredom, where you're just doing a lot of stuff, but none of it is very engaging to you.
Yeah. We're talking right now about boredom, why we get bored, how we deal with it, and what it says about us as humans. Mary Mann is the author of the new book, Yawn, Adventures in Boredom.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. How do you deal with boredom in your life? Do you view being bored as a good thing or as a bad thing? Do you think it's a luxury to be bored? And what questions do you have for Mary about her research? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up that conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Right now we're picking up our conversation with Mary Mann, author of Yawn, Adventures in Boredom. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234.
Does boredom stress you out? How do you or your kids deal with being bored? What do you tell them? And has boredom ever driven you toward something really good or something really bad? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. So let's take boredom, Mary, inside our homes for a moment here. We have so many things to entertain us, so many distractions. Is it possible that we as humans will just never be satisfied with what we have to entertain us?
Oh, man. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. It's possible. I think he's an anthropologist, Ralph Linton, who said that he thinks that the human capacity for boredom, more than anything else, like created culture, because we have all the stuff. Once you have all the stuff that you need, you still start making more stuff. Like once you have a spoon, you don't need any more spoons, but you keep making ones with different decorations and different things, because what else are you going to do with your making skills? So in that sense, it's good.
Well, and I think it's interesting because spoons and spouses are not the same thing, but but we do, you know, you talk about, especially in the world of online dating, how everybody's profile tries to show that they're, well, they don't put it this way, that they're not boring, but that's basically everything that they're saying is, I'm interesting. I've done this. I've gone here. I've jumped out of a plane. I've climbed the Himalayas. And really the bottom line is, please don't think I'm boring, because that would be a fate worse than death. So, but if we start our relationships thinking that, it's probably going to bleed into, if we're looking for a long-term stable relationship, those can get maybe a little boring from time to time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, life can just get boring sometimes. I think it's really nice to have people are sort of the best defense against boredom, I guess, other people. You can hang out together, you can talk together, you can deal with stuff together. I think what makes it tricky with long-term relationships is when you start to confuse the regular boredom of life with the person who's walking through life with you. Mm. And then it starts to feel like, oh, maybe if I had someone else, then I would be more interesting, as if it was contagious.
Let's take a call now. Another Mary. Mary in Appleton. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I'm calling more from the standpoint of those of us who are frustrated with the people that are bored. I share an education position with someone who just is so overwhelmed and exhausted and says, how can you do this every day? And I'm thinking, I love this. This is what I'm meant to do. And, I'm frustrated with people who are bored and not like what they're doing. I say moveon.org, get out of the way and get over yourself and find something that you love.
Mary Mann, how much does this contribute to passion, finding your passion?
Yeah, a lot. I mean, that definitely, I hear that for sure, Mary, other Mary. There's, like I was saying before, there's definitely some research to back up the idea that, like, the whole function of boredom is to help us figure out what we want to be doing. If you're constantly forever bored at your job, maybe try to find a new job. I think that's great advice.
Well, and Mary, you also said that, different things are going to be boring to different people. And so Mary in Appleton is not bored at all with her job, whereas her coworker is. And I actually had to laugh when you said riding the train every day in New York City, because I actually really like riding the bus to work here in Madison and looking at, it's a different mix of people today, or, I've got a different bus driver, or, what the weather is like. I mean, I also have a very short commute, so perhaps if it was five times longer, I would get bored. But really, I think in anything or in anyone, there can be things that are boring to one and not to the other.
Absolutely. Yeah, I totally agree.
Well, Mary, thank you so much for your call. Let's now go to Sandra in Green Bay. Hi, Sandra.
Hi. So my issue isn't so much necessarily with boredom in a job particularly. I found my passion. I love what I do. I'm a chef for a living, but I work very part-time, and that's because that's kind of what my husband likes me to do, and I personally don't like to work a ton. But what I find is that in my downtime, I'm also a mother of two teenagers, in my downtime, I find myself getting bored, and I find that nothing really fulfills that boredom unless I'm doing something of purpose. So if I'm not doing something that is maybe doing something for the greater good or has a specific purpose or an anticipated outcome, I get bored, and when that happens, I find that I kind of go into a funk, almost like a slight depression, and then nothing sounds like anything I want to do. So it's hard to find, the balance between, not being bored, doing something with purpose, but not doing too much where you exhaust yourself.
So it sounds like Sandra is saying, Mary, that that boredom is maybe a symptom of something that's going on at a deeper level.
I hear that about if you're not doing something that serves a purpose, you sort of feel aimless, it sounds like, which makes total sense to me. I mean, that goes along with what Mary was saying about, like, finding your passion and stuff. It is totally harder when you have time that's not structured. Like, that's sort of the nice thing about a job, is that it forces structure upon you in a way. And when you have to do it yourself, I hear that. I mean, that's hard for me when school's out and I'm not teaching anymore. it's weird. I definitely have to structure my time better, or else, yeah, boredom can be super depressing. That's a factual link between those things.
So if money were no object, would there be boredom? Not to get too philosophical, but what does money have to do with boredom?
If money were no object, would there be boredom? Yeah, I think there would. Well, it's funny. So there's different, the way that people talk about boredom is really different, and there is kind of like a class thing about it. Like Tolstoy called it the desire for desires, which I guess is what would happen if you had all the money in the world but still felt bored. Mm-hmm. You want to want something. And that's sort of that side of things. Where on the other side of it, to stick with the Russian writer's theme, Chekhov kind of just mostly wrote about boredom as like this desire for escape.
Let's go back to the phones, and Grace in New Glarus is up next. Hi, Grace.
Hey, folks. This is an interesting discussion. I'm one of those lucky people, I guess, who maybe doesn't really understand boredom. There are so many things in the world to do, to learn, to understand, to figure out how to do. I have a hard time understanding how people can be bored, particularly some folks I've known who've had higher education and fulfilling jobs and have been able to travel and all, and yet they still profess to be bored. I guess in some ways a lot of people might think I would be a victim of boredom because I had to undergo a pretty drastic change in my life. Eight, 9 years ago due to an injury and subsequent medical conditions. And so my time is utterly unstructured. It's only the structure that I choose to give it or not give it. I find all sorts of things to do. I think reading probably has saved me from boredom many, many times. So I really encourage people to read to their kids, to share books with their children, to teach their kids that reading is a good thing to do, that it can take you places that you never thought possible, that it can teach you things, that it can give you insight into yourself, into your friends, family, into the rest of the world. And I read everything from scientific literature to... I don't read romances.
All right. I'm going to leave it there, Grace, because I want to make sure that Mary has a chance to respond. So Grace is seeing a world full of things to explore, so she doesn't have any time to be bored.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. I still get bored sometimes, but I get that. I mean, I agree with you with books, especially. I'm so, so grateful for books. I think that helped me a lot as a kid to not be bored, and to the fact that I was going to books to avoid being bored got me so much more than just freedom from boredom. I'm so grateful that I got bored and turned to books to avoid that.
Books can be one escape. So can travel and tourism. You spend a chapter in your book on that. What about travel that can also still lead to boredom?
Yeah, it's a funny thing that people still get bored when they travel sometimes. I wrote about what's your specific question about that?
Yeah, I'm just curious because there was this nomadic theme in that chapter about being able to roam freely, and yet there was boredom involved in that, about having so much freedom to roam in your travels.
Yeah. I think it's interesting, like the history of tourism, how so much of that is involved. Like the roots of it are sort of involved in boredom. I read a lot about Thomas Cook, who was really, really into
And Mary, we're going to have to cut you off short here.
That's
okay. So sorry.
Oh, everyone should read about Thomas Cook then. That's where I'll leave it.
Very good. Mary, thank you so much for being here today. Mary Mann's new book is Yawn, Adventures in Boredom. And you can post on the Central Time Facebook page your recent experiences with boredom and how you managed to not be bored. That's on the Central Time Facebook page. The Milwaukee Repertory Theater's production of Jane Eyre wraps up this weekend, and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel took a dive into its archives and brought to our attention that 80 years ago, Jane Eyre was staged at the Pabst Theater.
And that production starred none other than Katharine Hepburn as the heroine of the classic Bronte novel.
The reporters were all over Hepburn, and the gossip of the day was that she was being courted by the millionaire aviator and movie producer Howard Hughes.
So the story goes, according to the Journal Sentinel, a reporter asked her the pressing question, "Are you and Hughes married?" Her reply, I will not try to do a Katharine Hepburn impersonation because I cannot do her justice. She said, "What an unfortunate topic of conversation. Newspapers do all the talking. We do none. I do not discuss my private life. In fact, I think it's nobody's business."
And yet, in 1937, with no Twitter, by the way, just telegrams, it was still everyone's business.
Well, I just love Katharine Hepburn, and that is such a Katharine Hepburn thing to say.
Something that we can think about in today's age, that is for sure. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.